Hi, this is Bernie Wides on the air again, Heritage Radio Network, and this is the Naturalist program coming to you from beautiful downtown Bushwick, where it's raining, but it's a nice gentle spring rain, and we really need it. So today's program, I have my favorite colleague. I'm not going to call her a guest anymore because she's more a colleague than a guest, Carol Butler, who, of course, has a book on hummingbirds. And the main topic today will be about hummingbirds. But before we get into hummingbirds, last week's show was about bees. I don't know if you listened to it, but you should, because remember, all our programs are archived. And we spoke about bees, and it was an exciting morning because my daughter, Erica, who's Chef Erica, and she has her great program on the network, established her beehive on a roof adjacent to Roberta's restaurant.
This morning.
So we all went up there. Not this morning.
It was last week.
Right. We all went up there and watched how it was done. It was really fascinating. But before we get involved in that, I want to tell you about our new sponsor, the Barter House Wine Company. They're proud to support the Heritage Radio Network and its community of food lovers. The Barter House works with family vineyards and small bottlers from around the world to bring only the finest and most flavorful wines to market. Committed to sustainable agriculture and artisanal production, which means small scale. No big machines, a lot of handwork, and they keep it on a small scale. It's good to keep control that way. The Barter House Wine Company offers outstanding wines at a wide range of prices to retailers, restaurants, and private collectors. To learn more about the Barter House, please visit them on the web at www.thebarterhouse.com or call them at 917-463-3076. And we're going to drink a toast again because we drank a toast last week to the setting up of the new
Erica's Beehive.
And we got a sample of the wine, and it's a very smooth red. And Carol, what's the vintage year? And
2004, and it's a Côte du Rhône Village, and its name, the name of the, I guess it's the appellation, is Les Coteaux, C-O-T-E-A-U-X. It's very nice.
Okay, that was a nice little touch. So we're going to talk about hummingbirds and a little bit about bees because we're talking about pollination.
And a little bit about butterflies, because we have this loose end, the cliffhanger.
That's right. I don't know if you remember when we did the program on butterflies, and we were talking how butterflies drink with their proboscis, which is a sort of a tube. I think we didn't really get into it. So, Carol, you want to start with that, and then we'll jump to bees and then hummingbirds.
Right. We ran out of time. We know that you've probably been sitting on the edge of your chair for several weeks since that show, because we don't think that we ever finished the story in the next program. There was a new piece of research that changes the way we understand the way butterflies nectar. We've been working for years in the Butterfly Conservatory, and we've been telling everybody, and it's in all the books, including my book, that the butterflies sip nectar from the flower. And somebody who is a liquid dynamics person, not an animal person.
A specialist,
right. Yeah. Fluid dynamics, that's
fluid
the term.
Fluid dynamics, right. Okay.
He did a study with some other people, of course, and discovered that, in fact, they do not sip the nectar. Some animals have, in order to sip, you have to create a vacuum. And a mosquito, for example, has two sucking pumps in its head.
Oh, that's how they do it, those suckers.
To suck the blood, right, those suckers, right. So butterflies have no sucking pumps. Mm-hmm. So the way that they imbibe the liquid is through capillary action, which I was thinking about it this morning. I was going to say it's like if you put a blotter in liquid, but I think young people don't know what a blotter is. A blotter is when you used a pen with ink, actually.
Or even a sponge.
Well, think about the commercials where they show how absorbent the towels are.
Yeah.
And they dip it into a colored liquid and it absorbs up into the towel.
Yes, that's capillary action.
That's capillary action.
Yeah.
And that's how
a fluid through a very small opening or something is capillary action, right?
Right. So that's how the butterfly. So I wrote this out and stuck it in my book in the conservatory, so that when we describe that, we have the research and we can say it more correctly.
Right. So you heard it here, folks. Right. The newest research on the butterfly drinking.
Right. Okay. Now you may ask, what about the other pollinators?
Yes, Carol. What about the other pollinators?
Okay. So from the bee book, right, we learn that there's a mistake in the bee book, because in the bee book we say adult bees have a tube-like proboscis with a tongue that sits inside it, and unlike butterflies and moths that use their proboscis like a straw to suck up watery nectar, which is what we've been saying and which we now know is wrong, almost all bees lap or lick up nectar that is more concentrated and sticky. That's partly how they share the resources in the environment. The bees prefer a thicker nectar than
right.
the butterflies.
More sugar to water ratio.
Right. A bee's, I'm going to read it because it's very interesting. A bee's tongue is encircled by rings of hairy cartilage at regular intervals. Imagine this is a bee now, this tiny little thing. And the tip of the tongue is a small spoon-shaped lobe that is smooth on the underside and covered with branched spines along the edges and top. As the bee laps at the fluid using muscles that control the tongue, a muscular sucking pump in the bee's head draws the liquid up through the proboscis.
My God, what a...
So, how about
it's amazing,
that
contraption for this little, these little tiny bees.
Really amazing.
Trying to visualize a tongue like that.
I know.
Mean, we don't have tongues like that at all.
Tiny, tiny little thing.
Tiny, I think. Okay, so... We're going to get to hummingbirds.
Can we get to hummingbirds eventually?
Hummingbirds in a
right.
minute. I just wanted to talk a little bit more about pollinators and bees. And in our last show, I mentioned the Great Pollinator Project. You know, a pollinator is very essential to agriculture, because one-third of our food depends upon the services of a pollinator, whether it's a bee, another insect, a bird, or a mammal. Okay, bees are the most important pollinators in the Northeast.
Well, and it's 90% of plants, right?
Yes, 90% of plants need an outside help in pollination. Some plants, the wind do it. The wind does
some
it.
Some are water pollinated.
Some are water,
but mostly it's
animals. Right. And the main pollinators are bees and birds and some other insects.
Well, my books are about the four major pollinators.
Okay.
So that's all you have to remember.
Remember, just get Carol's books.
Just
and
remember.
You'll be an expert, and you can go on a program also.
Right. But it's butterflies, bats, hummingbirds, and bees.
And bees.
Those are the main pollinators.
Okay, so one other word about bees. Most people are not going to raise bees with a hive, because you have to be really interested to do it, because you have to get it set up and all that kind of stuff that we spoke about last week. But you can help in the Great Pollinator Project by volunteering as a bee observer. If you have a little window box garden, or you have a piece of ground that you could plant flowers in, because the bees need flowers to come and get the nectar to make honey. So the Pollinator Project is organized by the Museum of Natural History, the Center for... conservation the Center for Biodiversity and Conservation, the CBC, and they work out of the museum. So I'm going to give you the website, and if you want, you can volunteer to be a bee watcher. And it's fascinating, and it's a real challenge, because there are 2,000 kinds of bees, and spotted in New York City parks were about 200 and something bee species. Is that right, Carol?
Right.
About that
That's
much.
Right.
So the main ones are the bumblebee, which is a big bee, the green metallic bees, honeybees, carpenter bees, and more.
Well, let's tell what they do, because Janet, this person we know in common, did this. I don't know if she's done it more than she certainly did it last year.
Yes, she did it last year, right.
She got several plants.
Right.
This is how it works. If you sign up, you get several plants, and you plant them in a designated spot,
mm-hmm.
and then you... agree to go and watch those plants for a short period of time every week. And in that, you bring a camera along if you have one, and you count, you record and hopefully photograph any bee that comes to your plants in that designated period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you report it in to the folks at the museum.
Yes, and it's really important citizen science.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, bees are threatened with this disease.
Right.
hive collapse?
Well, colony. We don't know. That's a whole complicated topic.
Yeah, we won't get into that today.
But there's a lot of problems with colonies failing.
Right. And so they want to take surveys and know how many bees are around it and encourage people to make a habitat that are conducive to bees. And that basically means flowers. Okay, so here's the site. It's Great Pollinator Project, one word, .org. Okay, go there and it'll tell you about how you can become a volunteer, how you can help in this project. It's really fascinating. Doesn't take any equipment, maybe a camera and a notebook. And that's about it. And don't worry about getting stung because the bees are so busy nectaring in the flowers that they're not even going to look at you because you don't have any nectar. Do humans have any nectar? Well, we won't go into that either. But it's mostly flowering plants and all of our food crops depend upon it.
Right.
Okay, so we have 1 minute left in this first segment. So, Carol, would you introduce the topic of hummingbirds, and then we'll get into it more in the next two segments.
Okay, well, try to think about it in a nutshell. I did upload some photographs of hummingbirds on the Heritage Radio Network site.
The photo gallery.
So there's a photo gallery associated with the different programs, and maybe that's a good place to start. There are some Every hummingbird photograph is beautiful, so I uploaded a couple of really nice ones. And then I want to talk about banding hummingbirds. There's one of me releasing a hummingbird, which I discovered. I didn't even remember I had that shot.
Mm-hmm.
Basically,
how do they capture the hummingbird? They band them.
We can't do that in 30 seconds.
Oh,
we'll
okay.
do it
we'll
in the next
that.
Segment,
right.
I promise.
We'll save it. Okay.
But it's basically hummingbirds are a New World species. They're only in North, South, and Central America.
We call that neotropical.
Neotropical, right. They like heights. They're often found in very high altitudes. And there are between 335 and 340 species in the world. So not too many. And we spent quite a bit of time deciding how to put that in the hummingbird book because they're frequently discovering new species, and people differ on the number of species that there are. But that's about the idea. So compare it to the number of butterflies. There are 20,000 species of butterflies in comparison. Hummingbirds are very, very tiny.
Give us an idea.
I have the size in the book. They're this big.
Okay. Folks out there in Radioland, right. It's this big, I would say, inch and a half, two
right.
inches, some of them.
Right.
And the smallest one is the size of a bumblebee.
You went looking for
yes.
bee humpelida.
Yes, when I was, I took a trip to Cuba with Elder Hostel. It was a naturalist tour of Cuba. And we looked for the smallest hummingbird in the world called the bumblebee hummingbird. And we couldn't find it. But it was there. It's just so tiny that they're very hard to see.
Right.
But that's to give you an idea of the range of sizes. The smallest one is the size of a bumblebee, which I would say a bumblebee is maybe 3/4 inch in length and not much more than that. But most of the hummingbirds that we have in the United States are bigger than that, but they're not very big. You could fit it in the palm of your hand.
Very easily.
Very easily. And
I'm looking in the book.
Carol's
so
looking
can
it up in the book, and maybe we could find that answer
now.
Size. So remember that hummingbirds are pollinators. So what they're doing is they're going to flowers, getting the nectar from the flowers, and using that as fuel to keep them going. And at the same time, they're pollinating the plants. So this is our first segment of this show. We have two more segments.
The smallest hummingbirds weigh less than a tenth of an ounce.
A tenth of an ounce.
Not even the weight of a penny, just to give you an idea.
Okay, so they're really teeny critters. And sometimes they look like insects when they're
buzzing around. The giant hummingbird is the size of a very small bird, actually.
Okay, so it's not very big.
Still less than an ounce.
Less than an ounce. Okay, so we're going to sign off now. Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist, Carol Butler and Bernie Wides, The Naturalist. And when we come back, we're going to get in some really good details about hummingbirds, which are fascinating, beautiful, beautiful critters. Hi, here we are back on the air, Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist, and my partner today is Carol Butler, who's one of my favorite, no more guests, but partners. We're a team now.
Thank you.
We're the frickin' frack of Heritage Radio. So anyhow, we're going to talk about hummingbirds, those beautiful gem-like birds that we see. Even here in the Northeast, in the springtime, probably June, they migrate through this area
right.
on their way up to New England and Canada. And I think most of the times it's the ruby-throated green hummingbird, which you can look up even on Wikipedia, they'll have a picture of it. Or if you have a bird book, check it out. And Carol's book is called Do Hummingbirds Hum? So Carol, you want to talk about that?
We have lots of illustrations in our book of all the different hummingbirds.
Yes, you have beautiful photographs.
Beautiful
in the
book. Color photographs and beautiful drawings, paintings by George West, who's my co-author.
And by the way, it's a good family book because it's great for kids because it has beautiful pictures and simple explanations, and for us adults because it goes into some of the science and some of the biology about the birds.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll try to cover everything.
Okay.
Let me just finish because we ended by talking about the size.
Sizes, right.
And I knew that we had the details in the book. I didn't want to misquote. I said the small ones are this big, which is just about right because it's 2 inches, including the beak.
Yes, the beaks are a large part of the bird.
Very long. Sometimes the beak is curved.
Right.
Sometimes the beaks are really, really long.
Yeah.
So the large hummingbird, the largest, is called a giant hummingbird, which is found in the Andes Mountains in South America. It still only weighs less than an ounce.
That's amazing.
But it's about 8.5 inches long, including the bill. And we have an illustration of it. The bill is more than an inch. The bill, it looks like it's about 1.5 inches long in terms of the total length. So the bird is 6 inches, 7 inches, 8.5 with the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Almost twice as large as the next size hummingbird. So that one's really unusual. In North America, the largest are the blue-throated and the magnificents. Those weigh about 1/4 of an ounce and measure about 5 inches long. So just to give you an idea of how tiny they are. Yeah.
Yes, you know, birds always look heavier than they really are because they have all these feathers. So when they puff up their plumage, they look really big.
Right.
But remember that birds have to be very light to fly. So birds have hollow bones
right.
in their bodies
Absolutely.
To give them much less weight. And I'll give you just an example of another mammal, the manatee, which is this big mammal that has to maintain its buoyancy in the water. The manatee has solid bones, doesn't even manufacture blood cells in its bones, does it in another part of its body, I think the spleen, because they need that heavy buoyancy. So their ribs are really solid and heavy.
Wow.
So that's the other end of the spectrum.
Right.
Birds, hollow bones, manatees, solid, heavy bones. So let's get back to hummingbirds now.
We should have a hummingbird next to a manatee.
Yes, but we couldn't fit him in the studio here, Carol. Come on.
Okay.
Okay.
One other thing I want to start off with. One of the questions we answer in the book is, can hummingbirds walk?
Oh, yes.
Which brings up another subject. Hummingbirds have these little feet, and we actually have some drawings of the feet because they fight sometimes using their feet.
Mm.
People would have said hummingbirds don't walk. They sit on a branch, and they're famous for hovering. That's how they feed. That's how they court. And so you don't think of them walking around. Some birds you think of walking like pigeons or gulls, but they don't walk around. In this program, which you all must watch, which is on PBS, it's on the Nature series, it's called Hummingbirds, and they repeat it from time to time.
Yes, it's a beautiful,
it's
beautiful.
It's just outstanding.
Yes.
It's really very special. And on that program, they have a segment where they found these hummingbirds at a very high, they like high altitudes anyway, and they found them in Ecuador at a very high altitude, walking around, nectaring from these tiny little flowers that grow on the ground.
That's very unusual. You never see them on the ground.
First time, I think, that anyone has recorded that. And they actually have video of it. So it's really pretty fabulous. They also have a wonderful Hummingbirds drink nectar and eat insects for protein.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And they also have a segment that they spent 4 days with a hummingbird in a cage with some insects trying to get a shot, which they finally got, of a hummingbird eating an insect.
I remember that shot.
And it's also just outstanding.
It opens its mouth, which
opens
is
its beak,
its
really
beak, which
flies,
looks so strange.
Right, flies at the insect and closes the beak on the insect.
All right, that's really unusual behavior.
So that's really, really, really worth seeing.
Yeah. So, Carol, the title of your book is "Do Hummingbirds Hum?" So, do they really hum? I mean, do they hum tunes like "God Bless America" or something like that? Or
not that I've ever heard. The humming is a vibration that they make from the wings.
From the wings.
Because the wings move so quickly that they make kind of a bzzz.
Yeah, how quickly do they move, the wings?
You ask me these questions. Very quickly.
Very quickly. So quick that you can't see the wings sometimes, right?
Right. Well, that's what's wonderful about these films. We have some still photographs. We have a great shot that George West, my co-author, took where you can see the wing rotating. But in video, and especially they have these slowed down, very, what would you call them?
Stop action kind of thing.
Yeah,
right?
But very, lots of frames per second. I don't know what the term is. And they turn the wings and they get lift on both the upstroke and the downstroke because of this figure eight. And that is, you very rarely get a good view of that. There's one online that I've seen, but in this nature program, they have it slow. It's just glorious. You can really see it beautifully, the way those wings move.
Yeah, and that's how they can hover.
That's right.
And you know what hovering means. It's flying in one spot, stopping like a helicopter can do it. They can stop in one spot, and they do that when they feed. Right, Carol? They're hovering over the flower.
That is correct.
And they put their probe. Do we call it a proboscis also?
No.
We call it a beak in a bird.
They have a beak and a tongue. They actually lap the nectar.
Right. So that's why they have these long beaks, is to get into trumpet-shaped flowers. Is that why they've evolved?
That's right.
With the flower?
They co-evolved.
Co-evolved, that's the word I was looking
now,
for.
Now,
right?
In the book, we have answers to everything in the book. So how fast does a hummingbird beat its wings, you asked. And the male ruby-throated hummingbird, when they're courting, the wing speed can go up to 200 beats a second.
A second.
During the aerial display. And that display, we always say, I also wrote a book about birds of prey called How Fast Can a Falcon Dive? Because
the
fastest
peregrine
speed,
right,
was the diving falcon in a stoop, which is when they're diving for prey. A fellow jumped out of an airplane with his falcon, his pet falcon, and timed it. And jet pilots have timed them. But, again, because of the technology that's available, they videotaped a hummingbird in a courtship dive. And actually, if you go by the number of, by the body length, if you judge the speed by the number of body lengths, their courtship dive, they move faster than a falcon in a dive. Only it's just for a fraction of a second. It's a very quick, falcon will do it for a longer dive.
Yeah, right.
And that's the nature of the aerial display. Mm-hmm. So a mosquito beats its wings about 1,000 times a second in order to stay in the air, just to have a comparison, right? We said the ruby throat in the display, which is really
that's the courtship.
That they don't do it that quickly all the time. It's very brief.
Mm-hmm. That's to show off how.
But that's the
how fit they are.
That's the fastest wing beat of any bird.
And how much was that again? A second?
200 beats per second.
Per second.
And that's, they do this crashing dive and then go back up. We have diagrams of that in the book.
Like fighter planes, dive bombing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Butterfly with a large wing surface beats its wings, could be 4 times a second.
Right.
Much slower.
A lot of drag on those wings.
Right. That's right.
Yeah. So that thing of them making that figure eight with the wings is really amazing, because most birds can't do that.
Right.
Most birds just flap their wings up and down and they get a power stroke on the downstroke,
right,
and the upstroke is just to recover
right
the other one. But this figure eight is amazing. That's how they can hover and fly right. so fast.
I have more about how fast. Since you asked how fast do they beat their wings, I could go on and on. No, but I don't want you to, I don't want people to think that 200 beats per second is the answer, because that's very unusual.
Right.
A ruby-throated and a rufous in their normal wing beat is 40 to 50 times a second.
Okay.
And the wing beats range from 8 to 10 beats a second for the largest species to about 80 beats for a tiny amethyst wood star, a really small one.
Okay. So, by the way, the hummingbird, if you live in the Northeast, the hummingbird that you'll probably see is the ruby throat. I think it's the ruby-throated green, because that one is the most common one that we see in migration time here. Especially when I go birding in Central Park at the Shakespeare Garden, which is loaded with flowers. And it's a great spot for birding and a beautiful place. That's what you'll probably
right,
see.
Right.
And we have about 30 seconds left now, Carol, before we okay. go into our next segment.
All right. I'm going to talk about how to catch a hummingbird in
okay.
the next segment.
That's good. And I want to ask you about that lovely pin you're wearing.
Thank you.
This is a silver hummingbird.
Silver hummingbird made by Ellen West, my co-author George's wife, who's a jeweler. And she makes beautiful bird pins and other kinds of images and other kinds of jewelry. And I got this when I was out in Arizona banding hummingbirds with George and was... visited with them. And
yes,
had a lovely...
the Southwest is a great place for hummingbirds. Yeah. They get many species migrating up from Mexico, Ramsey Canyon? Did
mm-hmm.
you get to Ramsey
yes,
Canyon?
Yes.
That was a beautiful place too. I remember going there. So we're going to sign off this segment where we started talking about hummingbirds, which is a huge field, a big topic. And we'll be back with our another segment where we'll get into some other details about the hummingbirds. And do they hum? Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, back on the air with our last segment of this program on hummingbirds. And Carol Butler is with me today, and we're going to talk about, we have about 8 or 9 minutes left, so we'll talk about as many topics as we can. And if we don't finish, well, we'll get together again next time and do another hummingbird one. But remember that you can see hummingbirds flying through your backyard if you have flowers in the springtime, okay? You can put out a feeder if you want to, but in the Northeast, you won't get that many hummingbirds sticking around. But it's a nice thing to try, and they drink sugar water solution. And Carol, I know that they banned hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
How do they trap these wizards of the air?
Well, it's very interesting. George is a licensed hummingbird bander. And I went out to Arizona to band hummingbirds with him, to help him band hummingbirds. I even have, I brought some photographs along to show Bernie from when we were out there.
Okay, right.
The question everybody asks is, how do you catch them?
Yeah, and why did they band them in the first place?
Well, they band them like they band any birds, because you or tag any kind of animals to keep track of the population and to study the migration and to study whether the population has increased or decreased. And George many times has gotten a bird coming through his area. They'll come to the same feeder year after year.
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting because they're very smart for birds. And so they come to the same feeder, and he'll find a bird that he's banded in the past.
Mm.
So what they do is they set up, we have a picture of this trap in the book. It's called a hall trap. You probably know what a hummingbird feeder looks like. You sort of have a general idea of this red thing with a bottle in the middle of it. And the hummingbirds just come to little openings in the red, in the plastic, and they drink
right.
the sugar solution. And the feeder is, we put the feeder on a stand inside a curtain, a mesh curtain, and the curtain is hiked up by pulleys, and there's a long string attached to it. I'm describing all this with my hands right. as I'm talking.
Okay.
And my job was to hold the string.
You were a stringer.
I was a stringer. So okay. I sat quite a distance away, very still, holding the string. And when a hummingbird came to the feeder, my job was to release the string so the curtain would drop down. And it's not as easy as it sounds. The first couple of times, I don't know how, it seems to me you just let go of the string, but the hummingbirds would get away. They would sense the movement of the curtain and fly out. So
you have to picture this. It's rectangular. So there are four curtains.
No, a circle. It's a circle.
It's a circle. Okay, so you have to make sure that it drops down all around the feeder to right. trap the hummingbirds.
Right. So okay. it drops down quick. If you do it right, it drops down. George's wife did it very well, and I watched uh-huh. her, and then I got better at it.
Okay, so you were an apprentice stringer.
I was an apprentice, right. Huh. So the hummingbird is now inside this mesh curtain that's about the whole contraption is maybe 2 feet across. And then somebody reaches in and gently grabs the bird and puts it in a mesh bag. One person said he uses a knee-high stocking to hold them.
Oh, that's good.
Which is interesting. And then we then carry the bird over to where George is sitting at the banding station and hang them on a rack in the order that they were caught. And then he takes them off the end from the, you know, in order. And what George does is examines them. And then someone is sitting there recording his observations. He measures the wings. He blows on the stomach. We have wonderful illustrations in the book where you can see a stomach without migratory fat. You can see a stomach that has an egg in it. Because he's
okay.
interested in whether they have an egg in them or not.
Right.
And he makes note of whether they have migratory fat. And he then takes a piece of very soft mesh, wraps it around them, and weighs them.
Mm-hmm.
On a little tiny scale, obviously.
So this is like an annual checkup for them.
That's right.
But do they have insurance, or this is, you know, that's a big problem in this country. And hopefully we're solving part of it
now.
I
think President Obama's taken care of that.
I don't know if hummingbirds are included in that, because Congress had that big fight and they only included 30 million Americans.
Right. I think hummingbirds are part of the plan.
You know what the problem is? They're immigrants, right?
I suppose that's true. Some of them are. Some yeah, of them are not. Some of them are
true.
Local
the
and stay then, put.
Yeah, the ones in the Southwest are there all year
right,
round.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the question of banding.
Yes.
People ask me all the time, how do they actually band them? We have a picture in the book. I'm really not trying to plug the book. It's just that everything is in there.
Yes, it's okay.
No, it's true. I'm picturing it. It's a little box with foam in it and these little tiny bands of different sizes because you don't know what size bird you're going to get. And mm-hmm. the legs vary. And George has an instrument like a pliers. And if the bird is banded, that band is recorded with the central banding organization. And so he writes down, the recorder writes down the number of the band, and that's reported so people know we found a bird with that band. And if it's not banded, he bands it. He just takes the proper size band and clips it around the leg.
Okay, and what's on the band? What kind of information?
It's a code.
It's in the code, right?
Because the hummingbirds are so small,
right.
It's less of a code than on a big bird. Mm-hmm. Big bird has more information on it. The code, we also explain that in the book. The code, this is all, George is very, very knowledgeable, and we have a tremendous amount of detail from his experience and from his many years of teaching, mm-hmm. and he's just really wonderful. We really have a lot in the book based from George that George knows about on his own. He's involved in a hummingbird monitoring project.
Okay. And many of the migrating birds are banded.
Yes.
For research and to check on the populations, which are dwindling because of loss of habitat and all that. So it's important to know which birds are returning
right.
to our areas in the summer. And even the ones that live in Southwest all the time are banded. To keep an
right.
eye
Any
on the
every bird that George caught that didn't have a band on it, whether it's a local bird or a right. migrating bird, he would band. We were talking earlier about how they identify butterflies.
Right. Similar. They band butterflies.
No. You'd need a very, very, very small band
for
that.
No, they actually tag them.
Right.
So we say they band them, but they don't put it on their legs.
No, they say tagging them.
Yeah, they say tagging them. And they do the same thing with migratory butterflies, especially our famous monarchs, which go to Mexico for the winter. They're very smart, these monarchs, because the food is great in Mexico. And they get there in time for the holiday of Halloween, and they really have a great time. But let's get back to hummingbirds.
Well, but the banding is interesting,
yeah,
though. I mean, the tagging.
Same information.
Right. We have that in we have pictures of that in the butterfly book. There's a little round sticker. You actually saw people doing it when you went to upstate.
Oh, yes. But that was for butterflies.
For butterflies. Yeah. No, I'm talking about that.
Right. There was a place called the Butterfly Barn.
Right.
I think it was in Delaware County, but I haven't heard from his name was Ed Wesley. But I haven't heard from him in a couple of years.
Oh, there's a raptor event in Delaware County that I'm going to.
Oh, that's good. Right. Raptors are birds of prey,
right?
Like hawks and eagles and
falcons
and owls.
Right. Yeah. Ospreys. But they stick this little tag on the wing, and it also has numbers and codes and a phone number.
The butterfly.
The butterfly, right. And so that if you find, and you were telling me they were paying people in Mexico $5 for each tagged butterfly that they reported in.
Right. This is the way they could keep a record of how many butterflies made it.
Right.
From, let's say, from Prospect Park or Central Park down to Mexico. So, also the hummingbirds, some of them migrate long distances, don't they?
Well, that's right. I was going to talk about that if we had time. I wasn't sure. I'll try to talk about it quickly. The distance that they fly really varies from species to species, and it's really hard to get as much data on hummingbirds as from larger birds, because you really can't put a transponder on them. They put backpacks on some larger birds, and then they download the information from it, and you can tell when they cross the Sahara Desert. We have it in the Falcon book. They have incredible information, how long they stopped, how fast they flew, every detail about their flight path.
Yes.
And hummingbirds are just so small that you can't do that right now.
Right. Even with miniaturization and all these micro circuits, it's still too heavy for them.
So far. I mean, there maybe will eventually be smaller ones, but right now it's a problem. Some banded individuals, rufous hummingbirds particularly, have traveled 2,700 miles one way. That's the longest we know about, from the northern edge of their nesting range in Alaska to the northern end of their wintering range in Mexico. And that distance equals, pause, I have to make a significant pause, 49 million body lengths, which is one of the longest migrations in proportion to the size of the creature.
Yeah.
They don't accomplish that in one flight. That's, you know, they stop and rest and feed and get more energy. The ruby-throated hummingbirds are the ones that are fascinating because they migrate across the Gulf of Mexico.
A perilous journey.
A nonstop journey also. You think about the size of the bird and the distance. It's 500 miles across the Gulf of Mexico. Now, they have research on shorebirds where they have surgically implanted transmitters on them. They're called bar-tailed godwits. They migrate nonstop across the Central Pacific Ocean, which is almost 4,500 miles. But actually, according to the body size of the hummingbird, that migration across the Gulf of Mexico is even longer in relation to the size of the bird.
How small they are, how tiny they are.
They fly about 25 miles an hour, which is their normal speed. It would take them 20 hours to make the trip. So you assume that they get prevailing winds and, I don't know. We don't know too much about it, but it's pretty incredible. There's one piece of research I wanted to mention that's on a different type of bird that rests. I'm trying to find where it is.
While they fly.
They rest. Right, and what they do is they close one eye and they rest half of their brain, and then they close the other eye and rest the other half of their brain. And somebody speculated that this may be how the hummingbirds manage to fly that long distance without any place to rest or any opportunity to refuel. They don't glide like right, eagles right. And birds of a lot of birds of prey do. It's just incredible. I mean, think about those little wings beating like crazy, and they're the kind of birds that, because they hover when they feed, we sit quietly at the table when we feed, so we're not burning up very much energy, but they're burning up energy as they're eating, and so they have to eat a tremendous amount just to keep all things equal.
Yeah, so they have a higher metabolism than we do.
Very high metabolism. Yeah.
So they burn up energy really quickly, but you have to remember that diet is mostly sugars, which is a high energy food.
Right, and they.
But still, going across 500 miles with water.
Right. Well, sugar contains 4 calories a gram. Fat contains 9 calories a gram. So they convert it to fat,
right,
which is stored throughout the body, in the neck, in the belly, around the internal organs. You know, wherever they can pack it in, they store as much as possible so that they can get across the. Get across the water. It's the Swainson's thrush that did the closing the one eye and closing the other eye. So that, of course, is not a hummingbird, but it's really about the best thought. I like it. I like that explanation.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
I think it needs more research.
Definitely.
It's going to be a tough thing to do.
That's the question. How do you watch a hummingbird?
Eye,
yeah. How do you watch a hummingbird flying across 500 miles across the Gulf of Mexico? How would you do that?
Very carefully. Yeah, there are other birds that do long migrations too, but the hummingbirds, they're so tiny.
Right.
You know, and like you said, some of the shorebirds have this huge long migration.
Right.
But they're bigger. And
when there are flocks of migrating birds, you can observe the flocks. There
right.
are in a lot in Israel.
Yes.
And
so do they fly in flocks or just their individuals? They never flock up.
They don't fly. I've never read about them flying in flocks. They're really individual birds. There's a time when they're migrating through. When George's banding, there'll be time of year. When we were there, I think we got 35 birds.
Right.
And the banding period is from 6 in the morning till 11 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
He does it every other Monday from those hours. That's the research design. But there are times of year when he gets over 100. And that's when they're migrating. But they don't fly. I don't think they fly. It's a good question.
Yeah,
it seems to me they don't fly in groups. It's just that they're all
maybe
going.
Maybe one or two. Maybe a male and a female
right.
would fly together. I don't know.
There's
about
one
that
other
now.
Piece that I, if we have time. Are we getting a signal yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Go ahead.
They also are fairly aggressive. They're very territorial. The males are very territorial. And people talk about being buzzed by hummingbirds. When you go into their territory. And there's some new research on female choice that, you know, that's one of my favorite subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And they studied Carib hummingbirds, purple-throated Caribs, sorry, and that the females prefer to mate with males who guard territory that has a lot of nectar, not surprisingly. But the males... Not only guard territory that has enough nectar for themselves, but they guard territory that has sometimes 5 times as much nectar as they need, and they partition it so that there's this very attractive batch of nectar to entice
flowers.
The females.
We're talking about flowers.
Flowers, right. Right. But you know, if you nectar from flowers, you deplete the nectar and it has to refresh.
Yes.
But they nectar from a section that they partition for themselves, and they have this untouched section to attract a female. And the females of the species naturally prefer these guys who have a big dinner waiting for
good
them.
Good providers.
Right, good providers.
Big spenders.
So that just is very interesting. That's a new piece of research that we don't have in the book. It just came out.
That'll be in the second book.
In the follow-up, right.
Right.
And hummingbirds, what else can we say about them? They have a tongue, and they lap up the nectar.
Like,
right.
Yeah.
And there's video of that, too. You can see them feeding that way.
Not like the bees.
Not like the bees.
Bees
right.
do it. Oh, the bees
well,
have
the
a
bees
tongue
have
like
a
that.
Tongue also, but they have a suction pump.
Suction pump in their head to pump up the liquid.
Right.
Okay, so that's good. So these jewels, I call them flying jewels because they really look like it when the foliage is flashing in the sun and they're hovering. Right. They're really beautiful to see.
The feathers are amazing. Yeah. We worked very hard to describe iridescence in the book. I'm not even going to try.
Yeah.
George understands it very thoroughly in scientific language. It's very complicated because there are bubbles inside the feathers yeah. that cause the light to refract.
Right.
But it's very different than pigment. We see it in butterflies where there are pigmented butterflies, which are just a color. And then there are iridescent butterflies where the color is actually reflected by the cells.
Or refracted.
Refracted, yes. Right.
The incidence of entry is different than the incidence of egress. Okay. As the light goes in, it gets changed,
bent,
and then when it comes out, it's a different wavelength, a different frequency.
If you're interested in exactly how it works, it's in the Hummingbird book.
Okay, so that covers the information for today. I think that was our last segment.
Yes. And I thank you again for inviting me.
Sure.
This is always fun.
Cal, you know you're always welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to sign off. And Heritage Radio Network, and our sponsor today was that terrific wine that we had a sample of.
Right, excellent.
And that's a new sponsor. And we'll be back in the future with some more exciting stories. And animal behavior is one of our favorite topics. And we've done that today with
Well, the Falcon book comes out in August. Maybe
okay.
Peter will come and we'll do a show
good.
With him.
I'd like to meet him. Okay, so we're going to sign off for today. And it's the naturalist, Carol Butler, and Bernie Wide saying goodbye till next time.